We've got a lot on the plate today. We're dealing with Christology, and today we're going to start dealing with some of the nitty-gritty, the terminology, and some of the stuff that goes underneath all these things we've been talking about. We started with Stein. We went to Bauckham. We're kind of thinking about some of the big Christological principles and this whole idea of how we know about Christ and thinking about Jesus these ways. Now we're going to get into the real dogmatic stuff of this, the real guts of this from a systematic theology standpoint. And what we're going to do is we're going to kind of crank through Pieper, and I'm going to cover a lot of stuff very quickly, but I'm not going to be able to do it in a complete, full way. So I'm counting on you having read it. Yeah, I know. But you are on the spot for what is in the text. And if you have questions about something you read and I don't cover it, ask, and I'll try to make sure I answer your questions at least today if I don't get to cover everything as thoroughly as I would like. But we will try to cover the waterfront here quickly. We're going to leave out a good chunk of Pieper because Chemnitz is going to deal with this stuff in detail. So we don't need to cover everything today. We've got three class periods with Chemnitz coming up, and Chemnitz is going to really unpack this stuff for us, which is going to be great. But Pieper does some things that Chemnitz doesn't do, so that's what we're doing today. Okay? Now, bottom line is, I'm also counting on you to know a little bit of your history from Confessions 1. And I know I'm counting on a lot today on a lot of fronts. But in Confessions 1, you cover Christological heresies, correct? Right? When you're doing the Creed, you learned about Arianism, and you learned about some of the other Christological heresies. Well, they all come to play here again. And if I had unlimited hours, we would spend a long time looking through these. Sayers and Sasse, both of the essays that I referenced to you in your parentheses on the syllabus as optional, do a really nice job of kind of overviewing these heresies and kind of what's going on. Sayers, surprisingly so, mystery writer Dorothy Sayers, same one. And she writes this really cool essay about all these Christological heresies and how they're still relevant. Yeah, Sayers doing this. Pretty remarkable. So you might want to take a look at those. But the thing to keep in mind with all these Christological heresies is essentially is they're trying to deal with the basic thing that's proclaimed from Bauckham and Stein, and it's simply the idea that Jesus is God. I mean, that's it. This simple sentence, Jesus is God. Everything is trying to deal with this reality. Now, we can say this a little bit more articulately or more precisely in the standard kind of Christological axiom, which is at the bottom of everything we do. And it's simply this. We have that Jesus is two natures in one person. And this is it. This is the Christological axiom. And if you get this straight, everything's fine. And basically, everything we're going to do for the next 2 weeks, everything we're doing today and everything we're going to do in Chemnitz is simply trying to explicate this statement. That's all it is. All of Christology boils down to this. Two natures, one person. That's it. Now, every heresy that has come up, though, has been essentially getting something wrong within this. That's where they are. And you can trace these heresies kind of through quickly. I'll do this real quickly. So put on your, you know, ready to go here, and let's do this. One of the earliest heresies was the Ebionites. Ebionites were a Jewish splinter heresy who taught that Jesus was absolutely fully human, but not really God. So what do they get wrong? Well, they get the two natures wrong. Because they're basically denying the divine. To turn it around, the other side, we have a heresy that denies the humanity. What's that called? Docetism. Docetism taught that Jesus was absolutely fully God, but only appeared to be human, and his body was merely a sort of phantasm, or we would say today, a digitized holographic image that was created for the sake of those who were looking, but it wasn't real. That's Docetism. Remember from your Greek word dokeo, it seems, so it appears. He appears human. He's not. So that's Docetism, and they both get wrong the fact that he's two natures. So we deal with those. So now we're going to say, all right, he's fully God and fully man. Well, the question is, well, how can he really be fully God? So then Arius comes on the scene. Arius is the next big player. Arius says, well, he can be fully God because he's almost like God, but not quite. And so God stays God, and then Jesus is God in a sort of derived way. And so then we start talking about homoiousios, similar, rather than homoousios. And now we have Arius. church says, less than really God is not really God, therefore Arius is wrong. And so we deal with Arius. And now we are all going to confess homoousius. All done? Hardly. Now the fun really starts. Now we're at about 325. So then throughout the 4th century, the 300s, we're basically trying to sort out, well, how can he be homoousius with the Father? What's that really mean? And now we enter the next round of sort of heresies, trying to sort out how he can be these two natures and how this works. And now we have heresies that starts kind of sliding onto either we kind of emphasize the two natures part or the one person part. And that sort of becomes where the rub is. And now for that we have our case in point, Nestorius. Nestorius, who says, yes, Jesus is fully God. And yes, he is fully human. But where Nestorius gets into trouble is that the church at the time was fond of praying and talking about Mary as Theotokos. Remember that? The God-bearer. And Nestorius just couldn't quite bring himself to say that. The Christotokos, fine. Christ-bearer, you bet. But Mary, the mother of God? Oh no. And so Nestorius couldn't quite say that. The church said, Nestorius, you're wrong. She is the mother of God. Done. And so then you got Eutyches, who goes the other way and says, oh yeah, I mean, we got this divine and human coming together in such a complete way, you can't even tell the human and divine apart anymore. What we call the blunder Jesus. You know, a little divine, a little human, and now you have something new, third thing out. And the problem here then, Eutyches is rejected as well because, well, Eutyches makes the mistake of losing the natures. So no longer do we have two natures, now we just have this new third thing called the Jesus Christ, but not really human, not really fully divine, something different. And so that's the problem. So every one of these heresies is making a mistake somewhere in here. Finally, this kind of comes together at Chalcedon, Council of Chalcedon, that says, all right, here's what we're going to say. Jesus is true man and true God in one person without confusion, without mixing, without separation, without division. And these are the four great negations of Chalcedon. You should know all of this. This is all Confessions 1 review, right? Let me see heads going up and down. Yes, Professor, you are right. I remember all of this. See, this is why we do things 3 and 4 times around. You guys complain, oh, we heard it all before. Well, why do you think you've heard it all before? Yeah, we do it again for this very reason, because I get blank looks. All right, the four negations of Chalcedon. Now, on a sidebar, isn't it fascinating that when we want to say something profound about Christology, the best we can do is to say something that's not? And there's a big lesson here. This is some of the things that Plaker talked about back in Systems 1, and this is when we do theology by, we call it apophasis, or apophatic theology. Remember that? An apophatic theology means by way of negation. In other words, it's a lot easier for us to say what something is not than definitively what it is. And don't think this is a shortcoming. It's actually not. This is actually a profoundly true thing, and it's very right. The less you can say in theology, the better off you are. Because just about every time there's a heresy, it's because someone has tried to explain something for us. Well, let me tell you what that's like. It's like this. And they start pushing their explanation. Before you know it, someone says, that's not right. It can't be right. And then they get rejected. Now, what you find really interesting in theology is there's a reluctance or a hesitance, really, I would say, frankly, an inability often to say what things are. It's a lot easier to say what things aren't. So the negations of Chalcedon illustrate this beautifully. Jesus is not mixed in a blender. Jesus is not somehow two Jesuses, which is what Nestorius ends up with. You got human Jesus and divine Jesus, and they kind of cooperate, but really not kind of coming together completely, and that defies the axiom. Because we have two natures in one person. One complete person, and yet two natures. So Eutyches loses the natures, Nestorius loses the union. That's the problem. So we have the tendency to say what things aren't rather than what they are, because it's a lot easier and a lot better way to go, actually. All right? So this didn't even finish it either. Nestorius and Eutyches get settled at Chalcedon, but we're not quite done yet, because now we still have to deal with, well, to what extent is he human? This was still kind of a problem. Arius is kind of chipping away at the full divinity. Well, we have others chipping away at the full humanity. Apollinarius does it first. Remember him? Apollinarianism said, well, yes, Jesus is fully God and fully man, and what happens, and this was a brilliant idea, you take the place of the nous, the thinking mind in man, and take that out, and what do you put in? The logos, That's where the divine logos goes. He's kind of pops into that spirit spot inside man. That's the Jesus thing, God and man. Cool. Great answer. Awesome answer. Problem is, it's not true. And then you have the Cappadocian fathers, remember them? Basil, Gregory of Nyssa, Gregory of Nazianzus, and Gregory of Nazianzus says, no, because that which is not assumed is not healed. Remember that little phrase? So if Jesus is not really fully human, and doesn't have a full human body, full human spirit, full human soul, then how can we know he were really saved? And if the spirit of man is not present in Jesus, then how can the spirit of man be redeemed? That's Gregory. So, I'm sorry, Apollinaris, you're out. Then there were others. So Apollinaris is the Monophysites, one spirit, then you have, or one soul. Then you have the Monothelites, the one will in Jesus. Does he have God's will only or man's will, and what's going on there? And the bottom line is always fully human, fully divine, full human will, full divine will, always everything fully present in Christ. Okay? And you know this from way back in seventh grade. Is Jesus 50% God, 50% man? No! You know the answer. Of course not. 100% God, 100% man. That's the idea. So the simple axiom is difficult as it plays out, but all of our Christological work, and there's a lot of it has been done, all stems out of the effort to try to articulate this. That's all it is. So all you got to do is just kind of keep this in mind, and things start to drop into place. Any quick questions on our quick historical heresy tour de force? All right. Wasn't that fun? Yes. You want me to spell something? No, I'm sorry. Just kidding.
Which council was it that had rejected that the two natures were kind of half and half?
That would be Homoiousius. That's Nicaea, essentially, that would attack that. Every one of the early councils, from Nicaea through the Ephesus, through Constantinople, and then eventually Chalcedon, every one of them was dealing with these issues, just different parts along the way. They were all relevant all the way through this. And it's not like any one of them kind of put it to bed. They just kind of shifted the topic to the next phase of it, and you can see it pretty much playing out through the history. All right. All of this is an effort to get at what we call simply the personal union. And that's another way of describing this. The personal union, and that's just simply the Latin derivative that we're familiar with. Or, if you want to call it this, you can also call it the hypostatic union. And this is the preferred term for Pieper and Chemnitz, the hypostatic union. But really, hypostatic and personal mean exactly the same thing. Latin is persona, which means the person or the individual instantiated being. And in Greek, it's hypostasis. Remember your Greek? Stasis means to stand. Hypo, stand over or stand under. So you have the hypostasis as a individually standing being. Or in other words, a person. So when you hear the term, the hypostatic union, think, oh man, we're talking theology now. Don't get all impressed. All it is just the Greek term for personal union. And all we mean is that Jesus is one person with two natures. That's all we mean. So this is the way to so much of this stuff. Just kind of think about the terms, and it's not such a befuddling thing. Hypostatic union means we have this personal union, same exact term, two natures, one person. Fully human, fully divine, in one person, Jesus Christ. Now, this leads into where we're going to go with Pieper. Pieper starts off his discussion by saying, we're going to talk about this under three big headings. The first big heading is going to be the person of Christ. All right, that's where it starts. And then the next big heading is going to be, if I remember right, is the work of Christ, I want to say. Let me get my terms here. The next big heading is going to be the states of Christ, and then he's going to finish with the office of Christ, the offices of Christ. So that's how Pieper's going to approach this. We're going to talk a little bit in here about the person of Christ, but not too much. That's what Chemnitz is going to do. And then what we are going to talk today as much as we can about the states of Christ and about the offices of Christ with the time that we have. We'll crank through those two parts of it because Chemnitz really doesn't talk about those the way Pieper does. But the idea of the person of Christ, Chemnitz is going to deal with, but I want to introduce you to you now today the basic kind of terminology and thinking on this so that when you start reading Chemnitz for next time, you'll be up to speed a little bit and kind of have an idea of what he's talking about. So we're thinking always here about the person of Christ. We're thinking about the reality of this personal union, the two natures in one person, Jesus Christ. And to talk about this, theologians have been accustomed for a long time now to separate this discussion into three headings or three genera. And these are the three headings that we call the genus. The first one is genus idiomaticum. First one. The second one is called the genus myostaticum. Genus myostaticum. And then the third one is called the genus apotelesmaticum. All right, those are the three genera. So the Latin word is genus. The plural of genus is genera. So that's why we call them the three genera, not the three genuses. I pronounce it genus because I was taught classical Latin when you have a hard G. If you were taught church Latin, as they call it, you would learn a soft G and you might say genus or janus. But I learned it the other way, so I still call it genus because I'm a stickler for my classical Latin. All right, so we have the three genera. Genus idiomaticum, genus myostaticum, genus apotelesmaticum. These sound really impressive. Lots of syllables, lots of weird sounding stuff, but don't be too impressed. It's not that difficult. Genus means simply category or place. That's all it means. That's all genus means. So in other words, the category of or the place of. That's all genus means. Think about when you're doing taxonomies in biology, right? You have species, and you have phyla, and you have genus. It's one of the categories. That's all genus means, is just category. Category, place, has that sense. So the genus, and then we have the three genera. The first one is the idiomaticum. Idiomaticum comes from the Latin, from the Greek, which means characteristic. The idiosyncrasies, you remember we use that word in English? Idiosyncrasies means the peculiar characteristics of a certain person. You know, the way he clicks his teeth, or the way he, you know, pushes his hair or whatever. It's an idiosyncrasy. So idiosyncrasy just means the characteristics. And idiomatica means the characteristics. So the genus of characteristics. Genus myostaticum, you can see the word majesty right smack in the middle there, pretty easy, means the genus of majesty or of divinity. All right. And the genus apotelesmaticum, again a Greek derivative, this is the genus of actions. Genus of actions or deeds. Okay? Genus apotelesmaticum. All right, now, what are each of these genera getting at? They're getting at the way that the human and the divine come together in the person of Christ and how this relationship works out in some facet. So the first one, genus idiomaticum, can be illustrated like this. The genus idiomaticum says that all the characteristics of the human nature and all the characteristics of the divine nature, so a characteristic of the human nature would be Jesus gets hungry. Hunger, emotions, passibility, that you feel things. Those would be human characteristics, all the things we all know all the time. Divine characteristic, well, immutability, wisdom, the ability to control nature, ability to forgive sins. So the genus idiomaticum says all the characteristics of the human nature and all the characteristics of the divine nature are given fully and completely to the person Christ. That's the genus idiomaticum. So everything that a human is given to Jesus. Everything that God is given to Jesus. That's genus idiomaticum. And by the way, before I get too far, let me think about, throw this out here as well. When we're thinking about the hypostatic union, when does this start? When does it start that the human and the divine come together in the person of Christ? Conception. At conception. So at the moment of conception, this begins. So is Jesus fully God in utero? Yes. That's why we can say that Mary is the Theotokos, the bearer of God. All right? So the union starts with conception. So fully human and fully divine from the moment of conception in the person of Christ. Now, also interestingly here, is it true then that Jesus has a beginning? Yes, he does. Absolutely. Because before the incarnation, is there a Jesus? Technically, no. Jesus is the name we gave to Jesus of Nazareth, the human and divine, this unique person that came into being at the incarnation. We have, before the incarnation, is there a son? Yes. Is there a logos? Yes, absolutely. So there is the logos, the divine son of the Father, who is always, always God in the Trinity, and yet that divine Son joins himself to human flesh at the incarnation, and that's the beginning of Jesus the Christ. So technically, there's no Jesus in the Old Testament, and there's no Christ in the Old Testament. There's the Son, and there's the Word, but to talk about Christ is a little bit of an anachronism. You're kind of taking back and reading back. And you can get away with that. But really, Jesus and Christ are terms that are really better reserved for the incarnate form of the Son in his incarnation. Okay? Tracking with me here? All right. So the genus idiomaticum has the characteristics of both being given to the person. Now we'll go to the next genus. We're going to skip to the third one. And actually, when we get to Chemnitz, you're going to realize Chemnitz numbers them differently. Chemnitz goes 1, 2, 3, and takes Apotelos monicum second and Myostaticum third. It doesn't really matter that much which way you're going to do these. The second genus says this, that anything that Christ does in his person in the work of salvation history, carrying out the salvation, the redemption of, and the restoration of the creation, anything he does fully and completely in and through both natures all the time. So we just turn the arrows the other direction. So whatever Jesus does, he does through both of the natures. So we could think of a concrete example here would be Jesus healing the man born blind in the Gospel of Mark. And how does Jesus do it? He spits and he makes mud. And he takes the mud and he rubs it on the dude's eyes. And he says, go and wash. And the guy can see. John throws in the washing part. All right. And so we have this miracle taking place. Are there human elements happening in this miracle? Spit. Hands. The word. Go do this. The fact that Jesus is there present. He can be seen. There's a human element to it. Is there a divine element? The guy can see. My spit won't do that. Yours probably not either. Unless something special about you we don't know. And so this is an example of the genus apotelos monicum. Another example would be the salvific event of the cross. The fact that Jesus dies on the cross for the salvation of the world. To die, he needs the human body. God can't die. So he needs a human body to die and to be passable, to suffer. And yet, his death needs to be salvific. So how's that going to happen? Through his divine nature that becomes a sacrifice for all. So the divine and human are both at work, genus apotelos monicum. Pieper likes to say that the genus apotelos monicum is the doctrine of the vicarious atonement. And he's pretty much spot on with that. I would agree with him on that. That's where it really comes through in spades. All right, so that's the second genera, or the third genera, depending on how you want to number it. Pieper numbers it that way. Genus myostaticum is a little different. Genus myostaticum says this, that the divine nature, in the course of the work of Jesus, because of the personal union, the divine nature sometimes gives part of its characteristics to the human nature so that Christ can do what he needs to do. So some of the characteristics, the idiomata, of the divine nature are given to the human for the sake of the work to be done. And the reason I draw this certain line through the Christ circle is because it's on account of the personal union that this takes place. Here's an example of what we mean. Jesus walks on the water to meet his disciples. Most human bodies I know don't displace water well enough to be able to walk on it. Jesus does. So the divine nature is clearly enabling the human to do something human natures don't do for the sake of the work that needs to be done. So the human nature is given a shot or a share of majesty. Not becoming God and not becoming fully divine, but sharing in the majesty. That's genus myostaticum. That's it. So you've just encountered the three biggies, genus idiomaticum, genus myostaticum, genus apotelosmaticum, and these are simply meant to say, here's how this plays out, that Jesus is two natures and yet one person. These are meant to try to articulate this. These are not in opposition to one another. They actually overlap all over the place, and almost any one of the examples I gave you can illustrate any one of the three. So it's really a very unfair test question for someone to throw a Bible verse at you and say, which genera is being shown here? It's really unfair for the grader because any answer pretty much works because you can make a case for all of them. Okay? So that's essentially what's going on here with these three genera, how each of these plays out. The church has used these simply as an effort to try to illustrate this. Now, what's also interesting here, just on a sidebar, is the genus myostaticum is the most controversial, which is probably why Chemnitz saved it for last, because some in the Reformation tradition deny it. Zwingli denies it. Calvin denies it. Because Calvin says, you know what? You give divine characteristics to a human, and he's not human anymore. He's not any human I've ever known. And so Calvin would say, in order to preserve the full human nature of Christ, we cannot allow the genus maiostaticum to stand. And that has all kinds of interesting implications. Like, for example, in the upper room, when Jesus appears to the 12, how does Jesus get there? Oh, he must climb in through the back door or through a window that was left open, because he can't just walk through walls, because human bodies don't get to do that. Seriously. Seriously. Calvin would say that. And then you even have the Easter resurrection. The tomb is rolled open. The stone is rolled away from the tomb. Why? To let him out. Hey, I'm in here. You know, kind of weird. But you see, well, human bodies don't just walk through doors, or through stones for that matter. But Luther, and we would say as Orthodox Christians, that the genus maiostaticum says the human body can do those things because this is a special human body joined to Jesus. And because of the genus maiostaticum, Jesus' human body can do these things. This has enormous implications for Lord's Supper theology. Because Calvin's biggest ace and Zwingli's is, human bodies can't be present everywhere and doesn't work that way. And the answer we would have is, guess what? Genus maiostaticum, Jesus can do whatever he wants. And you see, that's what I mean. These have really interesting implications, and it goes back to Christology, some of these fundamental issues. They're clearly at play here in these things. All right, any quick questions at this stage? Good. We're going to come back to this stuff with Chemnitz in spades, all right? And we'll let Chemnitz run us through this stuff, and so we'll be able to linger more and digest this a little bit more. So if you're not getting it fully, that's okay. This is your first introduction to this. Oh, by the way, before I leave this entirely, this is also the shining moment when you get to finally be able to know what you're talking about when you say, yeah, we don't believe in the non-reciprocity of the second genus maiostaticum, which sounds so very erudite and very, well, cool. Look, I can talk about the non-reciprocity of the second genus because because the divine nature gives to the human. What does the human give to the divine? Nothing. Because the divine is divine. It needs nothing. So it's not a reciprocity. We have a check valve on the flow here for all you plumbers. And the flow is only one direction. So it doesn't go both ways. So that's not reciprocal. That's why we talk about the non-reciprocity of the genus maiostaticum. And now you can use the highest, most falutin theological language that floats around and use it with confidence because you now know what you're talking about. All right. Now, enough on that because, as I said, Chemnitz is going to cover this a lot more. What we want to spend some time on now is the next section of Pieper where he starts talking about the states of Christ or the way that Jesus is carrying out his work. And so we have the states of Christ's work and the work he accomplishes for us in these states. Now, what are the two states that Pieper is interested in? All right, the states of humiliation and exaltation. So, we're talking about here is the contrast between the state of humiliation and the state of exaltation. Pieper spends a long time on this. It's the whole second section of his lecture where he starts unpacking all this detail about these states of humiliation and exaltation. And he does it in some interesting ways. He uses also some rather, to be honest, a little bit odd terminology that we're not quite so familiar with on occasion. Let me find my... There, that's what I wanted. Where he talks about this sometimes. This is started on page 280, basically, is where he picks this up. It's the second section of your reading. He uses a term that we're not real familiar with, and it's kind of an archaic term, but he uses it on occasion. Page 280, when it shows up, the state of exinanition. You guys run across this when you're reading? He uses it all the time. Did you look it up? Of course not, because you don't waste time. You tried. Thank you, Gary. Exactly. It's not. But if you go to the library, that's that building over there on the other side of the water fountain.
And we all didn't have access to
the library. it's open, actually, somewhat. But it's over there, and you've been back since Tuesday anyway, and today's Friday. So if you go over to that building on the other side of the water fountain, that thing with lots of books in it, they have this huge dictionary in there, big monster thing, and you can look it up in there, because I've done it, and exinition is in there. And you find out, when you look it up, that exinition simply means humiliation. Thank you, Peeper. And so all exinition is an attempt to be a synonym for humiliation, because people got tired of saying humiliation all the time, and he just threw the term exinition. So it means the same thing, so don't be too put off by that. So we have the state of exaltation, the state of humiliation, and we're thinking about how these things play out. Peeper gives a really great summary on page 282. And he says there are five things that we can draw out of the teaching of the two states of Christ, and these are all found in the formula of Concord. Because the formula of Concord spent quite a bit of time sorting this stuff out for good reason. Think about it. What was one of the big precipitating factors that led to the formula of Concord? What was the controversy? One of the big driving controversies. We have Calvinists, Sacramentarians showing up. We got Zwinglians showing up and working their way into the Lutheran churches. And so the formula of Concord had to deal with this problem. And one of the big issues is Christology. And so it's remarkable how many of the articles in the formula of Concord really are dealing with Christological questions. And this is a big issue. So Peeper says, from the formula of Concord, this is bottom of paragraph 282, we can learn five things about the state of humiliation and exaltation. First point is the humiliation and exaltation affect only the human nature of Christ. Only the human nature of Christ is affected by the humiliation or the exaltation. Well, that's kind of interesting. So the divine is not exalted, and the divine is not humbled. Now, why does Peeper make this conclusion following the formula of Concord? All right. The basic idea is the divine is already exalted. How are you going to make it more exalted? If you exalt it more than it is, then you're implying change in the divine. Uh-oh, big problem. Because one of our basic ideas about divinity is the impassibility or the immutability. Doesn't change, doesn't experience things. And so this is the big thing. Now, of course, if you're paying attention, you remember that Bauckham was kind of taking some shots at this with the whole idea of God being able to suffer, an idea of a suffering God, and suggesting that Luther is opening these doors and others have as well. And this is quite true. And the question about the passibility of God is one of those kinds of, right now, very dynamic, fluid things that a lot of theologians keep on coming back to again and again and again. And we have the tradition of the church, which has always said, God can't suffer. But the challenge frequently is, that's a Greek idea, and it's not a scriptural idea. So we'll see how that all plays out. But this is part of the driving thing. So Peeper's toying the line here and saying, only the human nature can be exalted, and only the human nature can suffer. And the way we say this traditionally is that when Jesus Christ dies on the cross, he dies according to the human nature. Now, if you're a guy who tends to stress the two natures, then you're going to say, all right, yeah, the human nature dies and the divine doesn't. But you have to be really careful, because now you can start sliding off into a Nestorian sort of two Jesuses, and that's not true. And if you're like Luther, a guy who tends to stress the one person, then you'll say things like, God died. Did he? Well, according to the personal union, yes, he did. Because everything that Jesus does, the nature does in Christ. And yet, not God, because God is God, and yet God in Jesus does. Getting complicated? Yeah, it gets really complicated. And these things are like, wow, kind of like blow your mind. And you start thinking about what's really going down on the cross on Good Friday. Absolutely blows your mind. The idea of God damning God, God being apart from God and yet one with God, and the hypostatic union happening and yet the homoousius continuing, so that even during his earthly pilgrimage, Jesus is still one with the Father. And so Jesus is still ruling the universe even while he's walking around as a human being subject to the laws of the universe. Wow. Just your head starts to swim. So that's what's going on here. So the humiliation and the exaltation are happening only according to the human nature, because of the reality that, well, divine nature doesn't do these sorts of things. And that's what we come up with. So that's the first rule. Second rule, propter unionem personalem, Good Pieper Latin for you, which means what? According to the personal union. Oh, that's really complicated. So all that means is because of the personal union. So propter unionem personalem. Don't worry about that Latin. It's not a big deal. According to the personal union, Christ possesses the divine majesty from the moment of his conception. So when does Jesus become fully God? Right from the very beginning. There's never a time when Jesus is not fully God. This is critical against all the adoptionistic heresies. Because adoptionism, in any form it comes, whether it's Ebionites or later on the adoptionists that show up, like Paul of Samosata to some extent, who would say, well, Jesus is really a dude, and then God kind of takes over in some way and joins him. And yet there's distinct. And so the adoptionistic heresies can be tested this way. If you remove the God part of Jesus, what's left? Well, an adoptionist would say a human being who's suddenly feeling very lonely, but a guy. Whereas an Orthodox theologian would say, if you remove the divine from Jesus, what's left? Nothing. Nothing. Because Jesus does not exist apart from the personal union, apart from the hypostatic union. The divine is Jesus, not loaned to or part of. Okay? Now, is Jesus still a complete full human being? Yes. But because the uniqueness of Christ is the very fact of the personal union. It exists from the point of conception. When does that personal union end? It does not end. There's another one to blow your mind. God actually takes into the Godhead human flesh for eternity. It's not like God became a human being for 33 years and kicked around with us for a little while, and then now he's back to being God like he used to be. Mm-mm. He's joined himself to human flesh for eternity. So that's another big, huge sacramental thing with the Lord's Supper. So where Christ is, he is human and divine always. Now, we usually say this as in an illocal way, not like he was during his earthly ministry. During the earthly ministry, he was present with his disciples, like, there he is, and they could identify. He's in the sleeping in the back of the boat, or he's over standing over there. Now we would say, where is Jesus? Living in me. He's there. He's where. He's everywhere. But wherever he is present, body and soul, human and divine, because that's who he is. You say, no, wait a minute. How can that be? That's a Zwingli question. Don't ask it. You simply say, he's God, and he's Jesus, and he is present according to both of his natures, even if I can't figure it out. That's where he is. And so this is, again, kind of a difference, because Calvin and Zwingli usually identify Jesus' body as occupying some corner in heaven, kind of just collecting dust, waiting for the parousia. In the meantime, Jesus cruises around his universe with just his spirit, but the body is not present. And we say, oh, that's nonsense. That's very Nestorian, because now you start having the two kind of things here again instead of the personal union. And this is interesting, because the Nestorian-Eutychian divide still plays out at the time of the Reformation, with Calvin essentially taking the role of the Nestorius, emphasizing the two natures and the full humanist and the full divine, and Luther taking more of the Eutychian view of really one union. And it's still to this day, kind of, which, you know, you're holding two truths, and which one you kind of lean on more heavily shapes where you sort of come out in your theology. It's very interesting. All right, good. Third point that we have here. Oh, I mean, second point. I already put that one up here. Is union is from conception. So, fully God from the time of conception. Third point made is the exinanition was not a feigned, but a real renunciation of the full and constant use of the divine majesty imparted to Christ's human nature. This non-use made the genuine human development of Christ possible. The terms non-use and concealment are synonyms. So, I'm going to introduce a term that's not introduced by people here, but I want you to get used to it. Kenosis is the term, and what we mean by kenosis is non-use. Through this whole discussion, we're going to pick a lot on Calvinism and on the Reformed theologians because their teaching is different than ours, and that's why we talk about them so much. Not to make them out to be bad, but just so you see the difference. Kenosis is the word that comes out of Philippians 2, and that's where this term comes from. And the Greek is, kenosis just means to empty, or emptying. And the verb form, kenao, means to empty. And it comes from Philippians 2, and it says that Jesus emptied himself, taking on the nature of a servant. This pouring himself out. Dr. Nagel pointed out to us that this kenosis, this pouring himself out, really a sacrificial language, but it's always been a big issue. What does this mean that he poured out? Some theologians, Calvin walks in these rails, would say he poured out his divinity so that he didn't come in his full divinity. He left some of it behind. All right? And this is sometimes known as the extra Calvinisticum, that there's something more to God than was present in Jesus. Now, what's the immediate problem here? How can you say he's fully God then? All right? But this is the idea, that he left something behind. Part of what's at work here is another axiom, which you should be very familiar with. Remember my rule, if Latin's on the board, you get to know it. Finitum non compax infinity. And sometimes you'll throw in an est at the end, which just means is. Finitum non compax infinity, which translates into the finite is not capable of the infinite. The finite is not capable of the infinite. Latin is so easy. All these cognates, it just looks like it when you hear it. All right? Finitum non compax infinity, the finite is not capable of the infinite. What does this mean? This means that a finite, material, earthbound thing cannot possibly contain all the reality of the infinite. That makes sense. So, this is the axiom that they trot out when we start talking about the Lord's Supper being the true body and blood. Christ being there. They say, wait a minute, how can a little piece of flour and water, a little host, contain the infinite God? Not possible. And you say, you're probably right. It doesn't make much sense. So then they deny the presence of the Lord's Supper. But the problem with their axiom is that it proves way too much. Because if the finite is not capable of the infinite, not only do we lose the real presence of Christ in the supper, but of what else do we lose? The incarnation. How can you say that the human body is containing the Godhead? And in fact, they're often willing to say, well, not the full Godhead. Whoa, wait. That's called heresy, guys. He's fully God. So this is the big issue. So finitum non compax infinity is a great example of reason going full tilt. And you say, you know, that doesn't make a lot of sense. That the finite could hold the infinite, and you have to say, right, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but it's true. And this is a great example of where theologies depart over the question of reason. And a lot of our evangelical brothers and sisters have this rather high, exalted view of reason, that God wouldn't make something that's stupid, and it has to make sense. And Luther, and those who follow Luther, like us, would say, God does what God wants. Whether or not it makes sense is our problem, but not God's. And God does what he does. And we don't have to use reason as a arbiter or as a standard for whether or not it's true. What's true is what God has said. Big difference here. I mean, huge difference. All right, so the key thing is this then. Kenosis means to empty or to pour out. Well, what's getting poured out? The divine nature? And we say, no. The Orthodox view of this is that Jesus is fully God from the time of conception all the way through, never without the full divinity. And yet, for the sake of the work of the suffering and death and resurrection, he does not use his full divinity all the time. So the kenosis means non-use or concealment. He's not going to use what he's got. Is he fully God in the flesh? Yes. Does he come rolling into every situation with all the divinity blazing? Of course not. He keeps it toned back. Now, we can use some analogies here, which kind of help to shed some light to a point, but we always have to be careful with analogies because they start to break down and limp very quickly. But there is an analogy here. You can think of several. It's a little bit like the big, tough guy father wrestling with his 3-year-old son, and the 3-year-old son pins him and wins the wrestling match. Well, how does that happen? Because the dad is not using his full authority or his full strength. He's holding back. Okay? Another example might be in the Christmas Carol. We've got the ghost of Christmas past showing up, and he's blinding poor Scrooge. So Scrooge says, hey, tone it down a little bit. And so he does. So does that mean the full effulgence and glory of the ghost is now gone? No, he's just scaling it back a little bit. It's still there. He's just not using all of it. Or you can talk about an army going into war, and, you know, we can just talk about, you know, nuke the place off the map. Could we? Probably if we wanted to, but no, we don't. You know, we hold back. So that's the idea here. So it's the kenosis is the non-use. And the stress is it there? Yes. It's just not being used. And that's the critical thing. Because if you start saying it's not there, well, then you got big problems with the personal union. And is the hypostatic union really real, or just kind of pretend?